Morning!
Morning!
Welcome to the India Explained podcast, recorded in London and San Francisco. One take, unscripted, no rehearsal.
Hey Bunty, greetings from San Francisco, man. How's things with you?
Yeah, it's good, man. In London, we had a fairly busy week because we were trying to do some home improvement projects, which went well. Which is kind of setting us up nicely for the back end of summer. We are now into July, so we've technically got July, August, September at a touch for summer. So, you know, I think that's how we are feeling. And today's a nice day. It rained in the morning, but not in the evening. So in a good place, in a good place.
Yeah, similarly here, we've got some sun in San Francisco. It's actually been a foggy, cold few days. I think Mark Twain has a remark saying that the coldest winter he ever encountered was a summer in San Francisco. So the last few days I've been driving. I usually love driving and I drive out a lot. So my son and I have been going to the South Bay and, you know, just to get out of the house. My wife's not that bothered by the weather, but today's really nice and we have a full holiday week as such coming off. We have summer anyways, but this is the sort of travel week for the 4th of July weekend. So, all right. So what are we going to talk about today? You had a stint in advertising, right? Early in your career in Delhi, and you worked with different brands. And that was a very fascinating world from what I can remember.
It was, Robert. And I think, you know, advertising in India has always been seen at that point, was seen as kind of the last refuge of the English-speaking scoundrel, right? So at that point, even in the late 90s, late 90s, advertising was the bastion of, you know, essentially English-speaking people there were a few advertising professionals who were kind of from the hinterlands, like the insides of India, where they were very comfortable with English. Most of the people who were working in advertising were people who took great pride in mispronouncing Hindi words. They were very there was a cheap thrill of getting convent education. So it was a set. And for me, being part of that set, of which I'm guilty, we were exposed to working with different brands. Some of them were really international, aspirational brands like Oracle, British Airways and Lufthansa, Braun, and obviously the Hindustan Lever group of brands. And then there were the other brands like, you know, JK Cements, Dabur Lal Tail and Dant Manjan. Then there was Panpara, Gutka, Chaman Bahar. And so you know, and what I found was this in this one or two floors of office space, you had to create this coexistence between two types of commercial entities, right? And these guys, it was essentially the same group of people working up ideas and advertising and
images. Right.
But they were having to kind of pivot. So the person in the morning was writing an advertisement promoting a male shaving product from a multinational company. And in the evening, they were trying to talk about, you know, pan masala. Rajnigandha, right? So there was this weird contradiction that they were struggling. So that led to a lot of interesting vignettes and insights in terms of, you know, how the world was. So yeah, those were interesting times, but a long time ago now.
Yeah, and I had, you know, I was not in advertising in quite the sort of way that you were, but I worked for Rediff.com, and in the early years, Rediff.com wasn't just the journalistic face that people saw, but it also had a web solutions division, and I got that job thanks to a contact that you hooked me up with, a gentleman named Indraneel, and, you know, the person who interviewed me was a legend in Indian advertising, Anwar Ali Khan, and he's done a number of amazing campaigns. So I did a lot of websites, State Bank of India, but we also did, you know, something like a local jeweler in Bombay, for instance. So I have some sense of what you're talking about. But I also, you know, having lived in Bombay, I saw at close quarters that kind of snobbery that you're speaking about. In fact, people would openly talk about upmarket brands, which were aimed at the educated professional classes with more disposable income, and then the so-called down market brands. And of course, with the social churn in India, things have changed. Now, you know, there's one company which in some ways actually, or there are some companies like Boroline and Dabur that traverse this space, I would say, because a lot of people in, you know, who otherwise would be like, okay, into Colgate and into aspirational brands also swear by Dabur. Like, this deserves another discussion of it. The whole series of products that, you know, Desis love, like, you know, Eno's fruit salt. My dad swears by it. Mother is a huge fan of Pudin Hara. But Dabur also has some products which, you know, can strike one as, in their claim, somewhat shady. So I have a theory that you can divide Indians into those who swear by Dabur and those who don't. What are your thoughts on that?
I think this is a gateway moment conversationally, right? So you use the moniker of Dabur, but I think you can separate India into, like, there are lots of things that unify us, as you said, but there are lots of things that separate us. So I think using products that have their antecedents in Ayurvedic, the backstory is Ayurvedic.
Mm.
There's a one set of believers who will believe that. Right. And people will totally embrace that. And to the point where their whole day is, so if you're feeling like severe, so they'll have basically over-the-counter herbal remedies for most illnesses going, and where there isn't a herbal remedy, they will use some combination of oral history and local gossip to create something, right? Like half a spoon of ajwain, a bit of honey, and, you know, Kala Jira, and, you know, if you have that, you know, in the morning and in the night, you know, erectile dysfunction will go away. You know, whatever the problem is that they're grappling with, right? My thing on this is that this split exists. Unfortunately, over the last 10 years, that has been kind of communalized, because, you know, and it's rampant in all sections. So it's, you know, this whole thing of, you know, surma lagake, like the tendency in the Muslim community to put like heavy dose of kajal on eye,
right,
to ward off evil.
Huh.
That is no different from taking chavanprash.
Correct. Yeah.
So there are like these things, but the secular counterpoint to this is essentially, you know, a group of people who have grown up inspired by this complete kind of denunciation of their own kind of, this is a story of their own kind of cultural milieu. And I know that, you know, the people of our fathers' generations were deeply suspicious of anything to do with herbal, zari booty, etc.
Because
it brought with it a certain kind of anchoring into a system of beliefs that they had been kind of categorically washed away from, right?
Right.
That space exists, and I think it coexists, but the divide is there nonetheless.
Yeah, I mean, in my dad's case, I think about it, like, you know, there were some staple of things. Now, again, even these things, their virtues have not been unequivocally established. You know, cod liver oil, daijin, halls, pudin hara, you know, fruit salt. But I think that skepticism about the chavanprash side of things, in my dad's case, I think it goes to back to his wedding day, because he once said that, you know, on his wedding day, there was some aunt of his who wanted to put besan on his face and arms. There was some ritual. He was like, okay, just, you know, do whatever you want. But, you know, he still doesn't like see what the point of it was till date. Now, there's a couple of things here, because this is a kind of minefield. Like, there's the whole erectile dysfunction kind of space. And that is another can of worms. You know, then there is the whole, there's a tail space, right?
Yes.
So those two deserve topics of their own. Dabur intersects with them. But does Dabur, like, I know that, I don't know if Dabur has anything to do with like erectile dysfunction, but it definitely has some oils, right? So let's look at that Venn diagram of Dabur intersecting the space of Dabur in the Indian middle class imagination, or the wider Indian imagination, and how it overlaps with the space of different kind of oils. And some of these oils are like really good, you know, like Himalayan hair oil and stuff. I find that they help. And there is this sort of historical value to, you know, massaging babies with sarson ka tel in Punjab and, you know, leaving them out in the sun to make their limbs supple or whatever it is. But there's also a lot of like snake oil giri that goes on with tel, right?
Yeah. Look, I think so. Dabur's business is in current day is carved up into, you know, hair care, skin care, oral care. So they've kind of crafted their company in very professional terms. And one of the things that they specialize in oils, I think, and if memory serves me right, there was this Dabur Amla Kesh, the hair oil.
Aha, Dabur Amla Kesh Tel. Yeah.
So Dabur Amla Kesh Tel, and then there was also a baby care product called Dabur Lal Tel, right?
Okay.
Which was again, and I'm looking now at the website. They have got Vatika hair oil and Vatika coconut oil, and they also, you know, sell olive oil, right? So there are different types of the coconut oil, olive oil, amla oil, and, you know, like companies across the world, they are selling into some form of, there probably is some scientific background where, you know, they've put 50 people through regular use of olive oil and coconut oil and seen that there's a marginal difference in hair growth or hair follicle health. So I think there is some type of science back. And you'll see this in soap advertisement, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Where people say that, you know, 70% of 25 people we spoke to thought that it was a brilliant product, right? You get that for a lot of hair care products. But I digress. I think the main point is there are some oils which seem suspicious, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Dabur baby oil, the Lal Tel, are oils exclusively designed for babies, right? Whether it's Johnson & Johnson or Dabur or whoever is the manufacturer, that I find very odd that you needed to have a particular brand of Lal Tel, which would be very beneficial to a child's development. That I found tenuous. Chyawanprash, I suspect, you know, that I have never understood how Chyawanprash would actually help somebody. But at the same token, Rohit, I have to say that every day of the week, I'm drinking a smoothie with turmeric and raw turmeric, raw ginger. Whether or not it's actually helping my immunity or not, I don't know, but it's really delicious and I feel that I'm taking care of myself while...
Yeah, and I have to say that the, you know, vestigial nationalist Indian in me gets a little riled up when I see, you know, Starbucks here advertising turmeric milk, haldi doodh, which Indians have known about for, at last count, a few thousand years, as some kind of, you know, new hipster invention. You know, there's also some like low chai called bhakti chai, which is being marketed by, again, you know, some like yoga doing hipster. And I'm like, you know, boss, don't try and like patent this stuff, like patenting basmati and so on. So yeah, there's absolute value to it. And I think, you know, there is a larger point to be made about the devaluation of indigenous knowledge. But the commodification of it, I think you're absolutely right, also leads to like a lot of dubious claims. And I think to me, what's very fascinating is that even as one set of claims are dismissed by, let's say, the middle classes, professional classes, educated, so-called enlightened classes or whatever, as being unscientific, they have their own version of kind of, you know, unscientific stuff that they tend to adhere to. So to me, you know, Dabur is kind of the fault line about that. Now, Pudin Hara is good, but, you know, it's not the kind of cure-all that people make it out to be. The other thing that Hajmola is not Dabur, or is it?
Hajmola, I think Dabur makes Hajmola as well.
Hajmola is, you know, just one of those things where, like, it's just the foulest possible thing. And, you know, I'm sure that there is some genuine digestive there. And look, someone's stomach is a little off and they take one Hajmola goli, it works. But, you know, man, if that dude burps or something, that kind of just kills the conversation, right? That's the end of the social event. And so you have to think about side effects also. But also the idea, you know, these sort of myths, as you put it, like oral lore and local gossip, that, you know, his heart was palpitating, he was writhing on the floor, everyone thought he was a goner, Bhagwan ko pyara ho gaya. you know, we opened his mouth forcibly and put two Hajmolas in. And then suddenly the guy was up on his feet. So yeah, this yeah. I'm very skeptical about.
I've just, while you were having this conversation, I sent you a video of a guy called Dabbu Uncle. Right?
Okay.
And Dabbu Uncle came to the show.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I remember this dude. Yeah.
He danced very well at weddings. Now, if you ask me, what is Dabba's brand personality? Like, what is the kind of the core Dabba customer, right? My mind always goes back to Dabbu Uncle, right?
Fair enough.
Essentially, he's the guy who's going to stand up in a wedding and do really silly dance, but there'll be a large proportion of the people who will really enjoy it, right? And he'll give them joy, right?
Uh-huh.
And I think Dabba's constituency in these kind of health products is like that. You know, whether or not it adds to the sanctity of the wedding or anything like that is to be debated. But the consumption of Chyawanprash, the use of amla oil and rubbing the baby with lal tail and lobbing back Hajmola, clearly there's a market where people go, you know, this is doing me good. This shit is good.
Well,
and you know, why not? You know, and so that's why I sent you Dabbu Uncle's video. If you see that video, you'll see Dabbu Uncle is dancing oblivious to what other people think, right? And that's probably what the Dabbu customer is like.
So there's something to be admired there, right? Like, now where I draw the line is, you know, someone like Akshay Kumar insisting that Chyawanprash would, and he must have been paid a fortune for this, will give you immunity from COVID. And then, you know, the bro got COVID promptly, right? After that. That, to me, it has very dangerous consequences. It's unethical. But otherwise, you know, it's a fair enough point, because when you think about the Western context, vitamins, for instance, I think the jury's still out. Like, I have to take vitamin D because apparently South Asians, you know, because of our darker skin, we don't get enough vitamin D naturally. So I had to take a really high dose. But when you buy those vitamin D supplements, there's a little notice on the bottle that says that these claims have not been evaluated by the FDA, which is the Food and Drug Administration in the US. So, you know, are vitamins beneficial? Generally, the consensus would seem to be yes, but there is some skepticism still there about whether it works or not. I remember reading that, you know, the procedure for cleaning out your arteries, putting a stent in your arteries, is it your heart? There is some skepticism there also whether stents work or not. And that's part of the process of science, right? That till we find something better or till we have categorical knowledge, we work with the best knowledge that we have. So the point I'm just making is that, you know, yes, there is a kind of reflexivity at work here. And as long as you're conscious about the limitations and what something can do and can't do, it's probably fair. And you know, we can't pin this down as mass superstition, which would be a stereotype. But yeah, some of the claims often turn out to be quite interesting. I actually feel that, you know, increasingly I've realized that Indians of a certain generation, uncles, I think they're just bored. They don't have much to talk about. So the virtues of Hajmola just becomes one other topic on which they can hold forth. Like, you know, whether Kashmir deserves more army and things like that. So so Dabur probably has not been served very well by the urge of Indian uncles to give Gyan.
I know. Well, look, we've talked at length of about Dabur, and I just have to be careful to clarify to our listeners that we have nothing for or against Dabur. We're using it as a kind of signposting. It could easily be Patanjali, right? You know, we're just picking a type of product, a particular way of using it.
There's no conflict of interest. Bunty and I have not received like a shipment of Dabur, or we don't, you know, like Bunty doesn't have, like, it's not as if Bunty's like closet is full of about, you know, 50,000 strips of Pudin Hara, and, you know, he doesn't have Dabur's balm, like bottles of it under his bed, or so we have received no compensation of any kind from Dabur.
And I think of all that from any rival of Dabur, you know, what we wanted to do was have a chat, a freewheeling discussion about how people react to herbal remedies and what's their place in this, in the cut and thrust world. And then I guess if it helps you, do it, but always, you know, keep the factual goggles on is what we're saying.
And we do appreciate one thing, like Bunty pointed out, Dabbu Uncle's dancing, like, there is, in the act of choosing Dabur, this is an attitude we call, and we'll, at some point of time, when the time is right, we'll get to the bottom of it. But the attitude is that, you know, you must live your life tel lagake.
Tel lagake. Take care.
So on that note, let's end.
Thank you so much for listening to us. Rohit and Bunty would like to sign off. Please stay tuned. Follow us on India Explained on Twitter. Keep listening. Thank you for all your support.